Second Bananas is recorded on unceded indigenous land belonging to the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh nations. Unceded means that this land was never surrendered, relinquished, or handed over in any way. We support the various strategies that indigenous peoples use to protect their land and their communities, and we commit to working in solidarity with them. We acknowledge that as people living and working on these lands, we are accountable to those who have cared for this land since time immemorial. It is our intention to continue learning how to honor this responsibility. Did you know him before this?
Yes.
Oh, sweet. Yes. Okay.
Only tangentially through MF Doom, RIP.
Oh, that Stempling actually. Him. Okay. Yeah.
So he does, and I think it's actually KMD maybe, or like an artist from a previous group that he was in, like when he was starting off from like earlier Doom days. They sample it, but or no, I don't think that group samples it. I think that a track that he does with like a dude from back in that group,
right? Yeah, a
collaboration later on in his career with, and he lays down a track that has the Eastern Market sample.
Oh man,
it's a fucking dope track.
Yeah, totally. Get your corn, ripe tomatoes. That's like my favorite part of that whole song.
But he has a really extensive collection of just like beats that he made. I think they're like, I forget what they're called, Special Herbs and Spices
or whatever. Oh yeah. 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 No, I know. Like, yeah. I know that album.
Four or five volumes of just like really short. It's almost like some Dilla shit where he just does a thing for like a minute for you to guess, for you to get the gist of like the track. That
he totally. Together,
and then that's it. And then you might hear it on an album later.
Or I whatever. Feel like he made he those like, because when did those come out? That was what?
Special Herbs.
Like he's released a couple of them.
I feel like it was early 2000s, maybe mid.
MF Doom and MF Grimm. Yeah, 2004. So I feel like he made those, like he put those out there to give other like amateur rappers like samples they could practice over or whatever, right? Like I don't know if that was his only reason. Maybe he just needed, maybe part of it was he needed money or whatever, and that's totally fine. Like people, like if it's your job, yeah, right.
What he does is like mix and like produce tracks too, right?
So
like
he raps and he makes. And it's just like, it's really cool. And it is like, it made me think of Jay Dilla as well.
Just kind of putting this shit out there. Just like kind of let your fucking, all your work just kind of be out there. Even like the rough, like unfinished, completely like fucking shambled together hooks that he's done some like sloppy synth work over or something. And you're like, this is amazing.
Yeah, because they are. And like,
it's not even a fucking seaside. It's like a fucking complete throwaway thing, but it's awesome and it's totally there. And he's like, just fucking throw it into the mix volume 7.
But I do genuinely wonder like how many other MCs and like even like producers or whatever brought those in, especially if it was 2004, like people were starting to get cheap computers, like, or even just recorded them on a fucking tape loop or something. Right. And then just mess with them and came like started their own journey through that out of those kinds of things.
For sure. Let's do it.
All right. Welcome everybody to Second Bananas, the podcast about the clout behind the clout that you didn't know about. I'm Joe.
And I'm Craig.
Yeah, today, no Wes today. He's taking care of his newborn, as you do when you have a newborn. But he's with us in spirit, and he'll be editing this. So shout out to Wes. Yeah. Wes with the edits. Yeah. He will be back. And if he's not back, we'll drag him back. Today, I have brought up Yusef Lateef. a jazz man. Well, not a jazz man. He did not like that term, and we'll get into that.
nice.
A saxophone, wind musician mostly, primarily, but he played almost every instrument. He was a multi-instrumentalist. Ahmadiyya Muslim, friend of John Coltrane, who is, of course, our banana prime. Yusef is – I'm going to be using Yusef as the second banana to John in a way. But Yusef Lateef was an African-American Muslim musician who was mostly active from the 50s to the 90s. Died in 2013, but he has – his discography is enormous. He's – I think just albums that he was the primary player on, he has like over 60.
Oh, wow.
And he released multiple albums in the same year sometimes.
Yeah, that's prolific.
So he was also, again, his religion really informed his music. So we will definitely get into that for sure. And apparently sampled on a, maybe not an MF Doom record, but an MF Doom tangential record.
Yeah, on his beats, one of the beats.
Yeah, Special Herbs and Spices. Right.
Yeah.
Because he, yeah. We'll get to that.
And on an actual, I'm sure on an actual track too.
Sure, yeah.
I think that beat was pulled from, you know, he pulled it and used it on an actual track with some guest artist or whatever.
Yeah.
Which is my really only exposure to Yusef Lateef. But well, I did go on to listen to a lot of his stuff as a result of being exposed to from that sample, which is the cool thing about... Yes, introducing white people to cool music.
So yeah,
the early 90s.
Totally. And my interesting, because my dad is a huge jazz fan. Speaking of white audiences, and he really, I think John Coltrane is probably his favorite. And I played the saxophone in high school, so I am a jazz guy. Actually, which is
do you mind that?
I'll use it, especially like if someone's just like, well, what kind of musics do you like? Like I'll bring up jazz. I think like the term is it's sort of like punk too, in that the term actually encompasses like all these different kinds of music.
Of course.
And I'm not saying jazz and punk are the same at all. They're like fundamentally, they're very different in part and whatever, but there's something
fundamentally similar.
Yeah, sure. Exactly. And they're sort of grouped together for a reason, but I also, I don't roll my eyes when musicians are like, oh, I don't consider myself a jazz musician or a punk musician, because like, especially I think jazz has a racial element to it that, and obviously that's decayed over time, but its origins are contentious, and specifically Yusef Lateef did not like the term jazz. He initially in the 50s was like, I want to elevate the term jazz. I want to make it much more. And then sort of after jazz did blow up and come into the mainstream, that was when he started sort of disavowing the term.
Interesting.
So yeah. And I think John Coltrane has also said some things to that fact, but I think John is a little different, but, yeah, he just basically said like, Yusef called his music. I'm going to cut some of this out. Yusef called his music auto-physio-psychic music. And cool. That was the concept was sort of what he said. The simplest form is that which comes from one's spiritual, physical, and emotional self. I think that's still kind of vague or whatever, but to me, he definitely believed in almost like a meditative form of playing, and a very like, intuitive form of playing, even with other people. And that's something that's really cool. And you can really hear it in his later music. He really got into more transcendental, less Western, based music as he went on. And there's lots of albums where he just did a straight ahead sort of bebop or hard bop with some funk and soul album that then had all these really interesting Eastern style instrumentations. But he also has albums that are totally out there that are just, you know, like he has an album called Meditations and they're all very abstract, synthy, almost ambient. Yeah. Atmospheric meditations. So that's really cool. And not to get too ahead, but I think people should go listen to him. I'll provide some links, not only to you can go on, you can see him on Spotify. He's on YouTube, but he does have a Bandcamp. He's dead, but his family still holds his estate. So it's worth supporting them. And the all the work they do to keep him sort of on the record, the historical record. So yes, Yusef Abdul Latif, born William Emanuel Huddleston in 1920 in Chattanooga, Tennessee. But when he was five, the family changed their name and moved to Detroit, which in the 20s in the South makes sense. I don't know what the reason was, but the South was not very friendly to black people in the 1920s. So
if you get a chance, why not leave?
Yeah. Which is interesting because that sort of mirrors John Coltrane. Also was born in 1926 in North Carolina. But then when he was about just over 15 or maybe 16 or 17, 1943, his family moved to Philadelphia. So kind of a similar story there. And I think that's going to be something that's kind of, there's these interesting parallels that aren't identical, but they're just kind of like really fascinating for both John and Yusef. And that's why John Coltrane is my first banana.
Interesting. Yeah. Yeah. Patterns that are common amongst like black Americans at that time.
And two saxophonists, like jazz musicians.
Musicians at that time, or just generally. Yeah.
And like their religious beliefs sort of, there's a lot of overlap there while still not being the same. So yeah.
For instance, everybody understands Detroit is basically the Mecca of America.
Yeah, that's a good point, actually.
I mean, I don't know if that's actually the case, but
I don't know. Too far. Yes, we're calling it on Second Bananas that Detroit is the Mecca of the United States. Yeah. Detroit is the Mecca.
We have no receipts, unbased assertion.
I think to put it more colloquially, Detroit is the Mecca of the great Satan himself. So, which doesn't exactly sound as good, but I think so. It's sort of like maybe it's an anti-Mecca. I don't know. Maybe that's too simple, but I think.
I wonder what happened with the Hajj. Is that how it's pronounced? The annual pilgrimage to actual Mecca?
I think
it was a bit of a weird endeavor this year, right?
Probably, yeah. I know someone posted a picture a while back of like a overhead picture. Like someone took a picture from like an aircraft or something.
Yeah.
It was from a distance. Maybe it was just like on a camera on a high building, but a very almost empty Kaaba. Like,
wow,
just nuts.
Oh, for sure. If you consider the population around the world.
And what I've seen what that place normally looks like. Plenty of people have done time lapses of it, right? And it's just so many people. It's like St. Peter's Square in the Vatican as well. It's the same thing, right? It's like it's never really empty, and when it's full, it's like full. So to see it so empty, it's like one of those really jarring things with the pandemic.
For sure. It's a bit of a reflection on humanity's current vibe.
Is not good.
Holding tight.
holding tight or not so tight in some cases. Right. So Yusef of course lives in the Mecca, Detroit. Again, both John and Yusef, they were basically playing professionally. They were playing in sort of groups that were in actual venues and getting paid or not paid. And I'm sure in some cases, right out of high school, they both were playing, you know, lounge sax in trios and bands at 18, 19. And they just were clearly two people who were immersed in music their whole lives. And you can tell just how good they are. So Yusef got his first saxophone by saving up for half of it with a paper route, and his father paid the other half. Nice. John Coltrane, I think because his father and his aunt and his grandparents all died together very close when he was 12. So I don't know if the saxophone was sort of like a thing or whatever, but his mother bought it for him. And the big difference I found was that right out of high school, John had to join the Navy to avoid being drafted into the Army. And he joined he still managed to join the bass swing band in Pearl Harbor where he was stationed.
Nice.
That was after World War II. That was, in the 50s. So it wasn't like Pearl Harbor, but yeah, it was interesting. Whereas, a big thing that stuck out to me about Youssef was in a lot of interviews, he talked about how being fascinated by nature, in particular in his autobiography, he talks about being fascinated with bugs, especially cool. like caterpillars and ants and stuff. And that was really interesting to me. And he says specifically as his sort of awe of nature is like a big part of his music. And I think it really shows in yeah. sort of like,
no, that makes sense.
Not only the music, but the art and stuff. So yeah. It's kind of a cool, I just like the idea of this little nerdy kid, like staring at a caterpillar and then like years later composing a symphony with that image in his head. That's yeah, pretty cool.
For sure.
He basically graduated high school, started touring with swing bands. He started on alto sax, but switched to tenor. That's for the sax heads out there. I don't know if you know the difference, but there's just different registers of saxophone. Like there's different
higher and then lower.
Higher and lower. Yeah.
not to put it too plainly.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything, but I started on alto sax and switched to tenor sax. So
there you go.
Yeah. Youssef just really, both of them essentially like were just in the scene, and the start of Youssef's biography is just full of all of the names that he played with, like from when he was 19 to when he was in his like 20s and 30s. Just a few of those names include like Donald Byrd, our old pal Lucky Millinder from the Sister Rosetta Tharpe episode.
Yeah.
And Herman Sonny Blount, aka Sun Ra. That one really fascinated me. I don't want to say like there is a connection between their music really interestingly. And he dedicates like a whole paragraph to Sun Ra and sort of his first experimentations with a score for a sci-fi film when he started using like synth music and electronic music. So yeah. So that's all the Sun Ra heads out there. It's pretty cool.
Dope.
From around 1947, that's when he and John met for the first time while he was in Philly. And I don't know how much they hit it off at first, if their friendship developed later, but it seems like they knew each other. And again, like all these jazz musicians knew each other because they all played in each other's groups. Like if you can name someone from this era of jazz, like John Coltrane, even the guys that are slightly older than like Duke Ellington or Dizzy Gillespie, they all played with each other. They all mentored each other. They all like learned from each other. It was really just like this big, huge like soup of like passionate musicians playing music together, which is really fascinating to me.
And a small ecosystem, right?
Yeah, big time.
Or a relatively small ecosystem.
Well, yeah. Small, but like very, there are a lot of people that, you know, like had sort of like name recognition from this era. Part of it was because like they all played on each other's recordings, and the nature of it was every single musician brought so much to it. It wasn't about sort of like a big personality like pop is today.
It was a collaboration.
Yeah, it was a collaboration. It was about bringing everything to everything. Right. So,
getting all the elements there and then cycling through, letting everyone kind of fucking flex.
Yeah. And also
on stage.
Yeah. Big time. And not being stuck to sort of one formula or like getting the same thing over and over again. It was like,
for sure. Avoiding that almost.
Yeah. And deliberately like pressing against that and like pressing against the idea of a star and there were band leaders and stuff, and there was still some of that. And, you know, certain names definitely had a bigger cache, but it was really a time of like just people just, you know, really just like mixing and sort of like making amazing, unique music on every recording. I think like that's really what I got from these two is like they were always both very like seeking to improve their art to the maximum they could and just being sort of like giving themselves over to it in a way. Which they also did with spirituality, which I think is important. And that was part of it. John was like in the bebop scene, just, he was known for practicing quote unquote 25 hours a day.
Insane.
And that's like, that's what you hear about a lot of these musicians, like Jimi Hendrix too. Apparently, like he would bring his guitar into the theater to practice while he was watching movies. But that also, I think, like really, I think I don't want to just make this all about this, but like they were also huge drug users. A lot of them, not all of them. Yousef wasn't, and that's something that we'll get into. But there was a lot of drug use at this time.
A common thing in the scene too,
right? Big time. And deeply tied to what they, I think it was very much like it was tied to the creativity, and that's how they felt. Sure. Like it was part of their process. And it, and like, I'm not saying like, don't like drugs are like very complex and all this stuff. And I don't want to like, just make people think that I'm like, nah, they fucked themselves with these drugs. They didn't. Like you can use drugs recreationally and have a great ass time. I've heard anyway. I don't know. I'm not saying anything on this recording. But
I can. I'll confirm that.
Yeah.
Definitely ratified drugs.
Wes, cut this out. No. this is a family podcast, Craig.
All right. Yeah.
But no, I mean, it's not. It's not.
Families do drugs too.
That's a good point, actually.
It's important, I think. I mean, the whole drug conversation and not making this episode about drugs necessarily, obviously, but there is a role that drugs have played in human history.
Yeah, absolutely. And
I think to deny that, and to also to like to deny it at the most base level in terms of like, well, if the government or whatever, some relatively arbitrary authority deems something a drug and deems another thing not a drug, then those things are good and bad, or bad and good accordingly, or whatever, right?
Yeah, big time.
That doesn't make any sense at all. So expanding your mind, or like tapping into aspects of your mind that in like your day-to-day consciousness are inaccessible or are less likely to be accessed, I think is completely okay as a concept.
And not only that, can grow you as a person in a way that you wouldn't have without having that experience, right? I do believe that.
Is it for everybody? Coffee isn't for everybody.
Yeah.
Right? Caffeine isn't for everybody. Acetaminophen, ibuprofen isn't for everybody.
Yeah.
But, you know, I think that there, as an adult, that there are decisions that you make as to what you're open to and what you're not open to. I think that there are risks that are involved in taking drugs, in taking any like mind altering substance. And, you know, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to dismiss something out of hand.
No,
it does make sense to engage with it. It's just like an idea. It's just like it's like anything that you encounter in the world. Like, do you reject it on the basis of like your initial assessment and like the surface assessment of this thing, or are you interested enough in it that you look into it? And I would suggest that anybody who is considering, you know, drugs as part of their creative process, as part of their recreational activity, as part of their whatever, like look into it and figure out what this thing actually does to your body.
Yeah.
And
big
what
time
the potential risks are, what the potential side effects are, what, you know, what the inevitable side effects are. And remember that if you're not moderate about it, certainly when you're like initially exploring something, then it's going to be too much for you. And that's a bad idea. Also, and there are some people that shouldn't probably never get near most drugs. And you need to know, to be aware if you're one of those people, because that's like having an allergy to peanuts and fucking having peanut butter.
Yeah, totally.
It's a bad idea. But with some awareness, you know, drugs have been a tool for
big time
humankind, you know, arguably in ways that we may not even understand. Actually, definitely in ways that we don't understand.
Definitely, not arguably. We're not arguing. We're sure of it.
I think it would be harder to disprove.
Yeah. Well, right. And the other thing too is like we're sort of talking about an ideal situation, but there are also a lot of people in this world that are hurting, you know, physically and emotionally.
That's
like
a moral side of
it. And whether or not they should turn to these drugs as a way to escape, sometimes they don't really have a choice because of a lot of reasons, because getting a doctor's prescription is out of their reach for something that's sanctioned, because they don't have, they can't even go to therapy or therapy didn't exist or whatever. And like, I think it is important to note, like, a lot of these jazz musicians were like, this was the era of like, not only World War II, the atomic bomb, it was the first beginnings of sort of like any sort of black liberation movement. And these are two highly visible black figures in that era, like literally active from like their childhood was in the 20s. Their early adulthood was in the 40s. And then of course they were in their like, you know, 30s and 40s and even their 50s a bit during the civil rights movement. And that's like, that's something we'll definitely get into, but like, you know, how many of these guys, A, not only served in, you know, World War II or Korea, and then came back and just experienced all the shit that they probably did experience as a black American, right? Like,
oh my goodness. Yeah.
Sacrifice for this idea of your country or whatever, and then come back and that country hates you. And that country is founded upon making it harder for you to live, you know?
But then wait, you as individuals are like, you know, gifted and are like raised up on to a certain extent, you know, maybe not in the same way as a white artist of the time might be, but embraced by at least parts of society.
Yeah, totally. Like
encouraged and like gassed up. And so then there's like this cognitive dissonance of like, what the fuck is going on here? How come nobody respects like my people the same way that I seem to get it, like individual respect?
Well, you know, and
for my gift or for my discipline or for everything that, you know, everything that goes into being an artist
and the pressure of being that person who has to speak for everybody. Absolutely. And having to be that talented 10th or whatever.
Yeah. Incredible pressure.
Yeah. So like, that's the thing is like and then not having access, you know, we didn't like the 60s was not exactly like brimming with compassion for people with mental health issues, whatever, right. You know?
That's a really quick and important addendum to my little tirade about drugs is that oftentimes it's really hard to avoid trying to gloss over your own unexplored fucking mental health shit.
Yeah.
By self-medicating, by replacing actual reflection and like struggle and fucking figuring out your shit and seeing people who are professionals who can help you with this shit. And the problem is when that's out of reach for you, when self-medication is closer in your reach, is more readily available. Oftentimes that ends up being the default, right? And then, I mean, that's a terrible situation.
Exactly. Yeah.
Not to make light of any of it, but just, you know, I wouldn't want to gloss over drugs as a concept one way or the other.
Right? Yeah. I think that's the hard part is like, it's such a tangential thing to this story, but I want to talk about it because
it's so central.
Because otherwise people just bring their fucking bullshit baggage to it. And then you're like, no, that's not what fuck. Fine.
But if you talk to John Coltrane after a show or before a show or whatever in his day-to-day existence in that time, it would be central to actually.
Yeah, that's right. Absolutely true. And
which is the wild thing. So it's not tangential. It's at the core.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's interesting you say that because he also definitely took drugs to enhance his performance as a musician. Right. But the problem was he was always dependable once he got on stage and put the horn in his mouth. The problem was everything else around that fell to shit. And that was the thing for him, right? He just like, he would just show up late. He'd be totally fucked. Then he'd start playing and he couldn't stop playing because he was so high. And that was, and there was like a story about like Miles Davis, like just like pushing him into a corner and being like, you have to stop playing between, cause he would go off when he was really high and probably not even when he was high, he just, while the band took a break, he would go into the corner of the green room and just play. And that's fucked too. Cause like, that's part of it is like, he couldn't separate. He just had to do it all the time. And that can be a beautiful thing, but it can just like drugs, like work can fucking kill you. And even if it's work you love, right, you can totally get into an unhealthy practice of it. And I think he did. And I think it was alongside the heroin and alcohol use, especially. There's an old story about Charlie Parker, who is one of the greatest players of all time. Apparently he struck a deal with his heroin dealer where the heroin dealer would get 30% of his earnings. He'd just supply Charlie Parker with heroin whenever he needed it.
Jesus.
And that's like a complete dependency, right? Oh, yeah. Which, you know, but if you need that to do your job, that's kind of the thing. You're not going to give it up.
Right. And you know that dealer is going to be like making sure you're stocked up.
Because and they have a vested interest in continuing to give it to you, right? And not even in a way of like maliciousness.
Well, sure, but.
Well, some of them are malicious, yeah.
Whether or not that's the end result. Well, no, I mean, maliciousness is intent. You're absolutely right.
I don't know.
It's terrible nonetheless.
We're an ethics podcast now. We're going to discuss intent versus action and really break it down here. No. I think.
So Youssef avoided this.
I think Youssef, I don't know if he just never did it or if he tried it and didn't like it. He did definitely seem in his autobiography to sort of indicate that he never really got into it. Like, and he said he did. It's pretty clear that he had to shut some people out of his life over it. Or at least, you know, like separate himself from them. And I don't know if he did that with John, because him and John were really good friends, but he definitely has a very like, these people are suffering and they had a dependency and it's not something to be like dismissed, but like sometimes I had to shut them out. And I wonder if he maybe had to do that with John or something like that. I don't know. But he definitely managed to avoid it for the most part. This might have even been part of the reason he embraced religion so much. Like maybe he saw what was going on with other musicians and just didn't go for it. Or that's sort of what made him embrace religion instead, because he felt like it was a way to keep him from falling into that. Right.
Interesting. Yeah.
So, yeah, I don't know. I wonder what him and that, maybe that was the falling out between him and Sun Ra.
Maybe
Sun Ra doesn't do drugs. I'm not sure. I can't remember. Either way. In 1949, let's jump back on track here, Youssef joined Dizzy Gillespie's band, which is really cool. And it just shows like that continuum, right, of like going from these big band leaders all the way to sort of the hard bop and like 1959 and new jazz and stuff like that. But one of the most interesting things is there's a little documentary on YouTube of Youssef, and it's just someone went to his home in New Jersey when he was like in his 70s or 80s. And just filmed him like practicing, but also like interviewed him. And it just cuts between these two really seamlessly. It's a cool, just Google like Youssef Lateef on YouTube and you'll find it. But he there's a story he tells, and I'll put the link in the show notes, where they'd sort of like watch Dizzy's movements. Like he had like signals with his arms and elbows that he'd show when he wanted them to like hold a note, kind of like a conductor or whatever. And he would go up or down to make them like scoop up or down and stuff like that. And he just, I think that really must've been sort of part of Youssef's journey into this whole idea of like auto-physio psychic music. Sort of like that it's not, I don't think mechanical is the right term. I don't know what to call it, but sort of that like deeper sort of instinctual kind of playing.
Yeah. Well, audio physical sounds like it captures it.
Yeah, but, exactly. Yeah. So it's like all these fancy Latin words.
I always think it's really cool when you've watched a live performer enough to have been able to pick up on stuff like that.
Oh yeah, totally.
Or know their music well enough and have seen them perform live, and you can be like, like, I know this is coming, and like, oh yeah, they're over like kind of doing whatever thing they do when they put their harmonica on or whatever it is. You know? Like there's just the subtle little kind of things.
Just coming to know those things.
And then all the way to conducting with your elbow.
While
you're playing the sax or whatever.
Right? Exactly. Yeah. Amazing. Yeah, totally. And I think like that was something he clearly has that reverence for Dizzy. Like he clearly, and that was the other thing, he clearly like studied all these players, and not only studied, but like he was apparently a big mentor to Sonny Rollins, who's a newer sax player, sort of a generation later than him.
Right.
but this was sort of the term he used to replace jazz as the term he used. But there is like a big article called Yusef Lateef's Autophysiopsychic Quest. That's a really simple word to say, huh? Autophysiopsychic. So I'll put that in the link too. I think I got a lot out of it. And I think people will too, if they're kind of interested in this whole idea. Meanwhile, while he's sort of playing with Dizzy Gillespie and playing with all these big bands, John is much more, he's in Miles Davis's band. He's in, he's out. He fights with Miles Davis a lot. That's all been well recorded. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. Which is funny because I've also heard that like Miles Davis was a person that got him hooked on drugs in the first place. That's never not confirmed, but like, that's definitely something. And Miles Davis was like kind of a piece of shit in a lot of ways. But he was also, you know,
super talented
and on a lot of drugs himself. And you know, going through all of the same things that John was with a completely different approach to life, you know? So,
everyone's on their journey.
Yeah.
Ships passing in there.
Some of them are scuzzier than others. Yeah. The nice thing is this is like one of the few, like jazz and jazz music in this sort of whole scene is one of the few things that has been way over. Like there's so much material out there about it. There's so much attention on it and like talk about it and even like academic stuff about it that it's a lot. It took me a long time because I was just looking at all these different things and being like, wow, what the fuck? Yeah. Like I have so much material to draw from that it's kind of daunting. Really,
hallmark like American thing. Like,
yeah.
A genre, a whole ass fucking genre of music that was forged in like pain and racial strife and
big time
brilliance and creativity and hope and joy and fucking madness and everything in between.
And just being a genre that is all about, sorry, go ahead.
Absolutely. But just to be like super underground and like improvised and ground level grassroots. And then also like completely corporatized and commercialized and commodified.
Yeah. Right now. One of the first,
yeah, 17 different fucking prepackaged iterations
with everything bleached and whitened and improved, quote unquote, improved, you know.
Exactly. It's kind of archetype American fucking thing, like cultural fucking thing.
It was one of the first, like we talked about this kind of not only in like the Peter Tosh episode, but like the repackaging of counterculture and the way it's like co-opted into capitalism or whatever, right? Like taking the surface levels of it and even using the figures who actually believed in it and used it as a countercultural and were, you know, Death to America guys or the Great Satan guys or whatever, but like turning it back into something that then is like a product.
Right.
That you can sell and make money off of and defang, you know, or whether or not it was even intended for that directly or whether it just had that effect. Right. Like, and that's something that probably also pushed, Yusef into converting. And so, I just want to say a little more about, John Coltrane is that he was also a big, innovator. He developed this sort of sheets of sound improvisational style with Miles Davis, where he's just playing a shitload of notes, that exactly the kind of music you play when you're on a lot of drugs. and just like really like fascinating. And then what's interesting is that was sort of around the time he started playing with Yusef and a bunch of other musicians like McCoy Tyner, who were also, Muslims, like American, African-American Muslims. And a lot of them were Ahmadiyya Muslims, including Yusef. There's sort of been a big, it was like debate over whether John Coltrane was like secretly a Muslim or sort of like a crypto Muslim or whatever. That's not super important, I don't think, because I think ultimately he was whatever he was, his belief in God and this sort of certain beliefs about God were clearly quite important to him. So, and more importantly, it seemed like neither Yusef or John seemed to care that they didn't fucking believe in the exact same dogma, right? I think that's important to their friendship. They were both clearly like quiet, gentle guys. And I think that was what drew them to each other in a lot of ways. Meanwhile, Yusef, while John is sort of like just absolutely being a mad lad on stage, he converts to Ahmadiyyam Islam, which is a very specific form of Islam. They're, the Ahmadi Muslims, interestingly enough, I found out they believe that the Messiah or the Mahdi or whatever has come already.
Right.
And coincidentally, it's the guy that founded their movement, just completely coincidentally.
There you go.
The movement sort of actually came out of British occupied India at the end of the 19th century. And this guy just sort of said like, yeah, I'm the Mahdi. And here's what you want to believe. And they're really big on proselytizing and spreading everywhere. But they do believe that Hazrat Mirza Ghulam Ahmad is the Mahdi, and he will appear at the end times to rid the world of evil and injustice. Kind of a hot take for other groups of Muslims who don't believe that. Right. So they have a very specific place in Muslim culture, which I don't want to speak on too much, because sure. I'm not a fucking expert and I'm not a Muslim at all.
But like in any of the big tent religions, there's friction between
the two factors. Yeah, it's like the same thing as like, you know, people who believe Jesus wasn't God or whatever. You know, there are those quote unquote Christian sects, and they are controversial within Christianity too. So I think that's important to note.
Flavor of belief.
Yeah, totally. It's flavors, tasty flavors. I think like the other thing that's interesting about Ahmadiyya too is one of their big emphasis is science and faith are not in conflict, that science is an important part of faith and it's a way to know God's creation better.
Cool.
That's good. It's progressive. It's not like they definitely sort of like put their own spin on it. And I don't think they necessarily like believe like everything that science says is correct or whatever. Like they may have some like specific ways of interpreting that, but clearly for a guy like Yusef who loves nature, like this sort of like comes into his head and he's like, neat. The other thing that they're very big on is like they are clearly quite an image conscious and sort of like very public. Like if you go on the Ahmadiyya Canada website, there's pictures of them like with John Tory, the mayor of Toronto, and stuff like that. So they're not like they're sort of like a very like they have an outlook of like we're here to get along. And their founder specifically denounced quote unquote jihad by the sword, and emphasize jihad by the pen. Is very like denouncing political or like physical violence and sort of and use of force as a way to strive or whatever, but very much being like, we're still Muslims. We're still gonna put ourselves out there and make ourselves known and say, we are the one true religion. This is what we believe. We want you to come to us. So that they're just sort of like a sect that wants to like, put on a big friendly face and not in a bad way, just in a like welcome people into the religion and sort of like in a very direct and open, but non-confrontational way. That's everything I got about the Ahmadiyya Muslim movement, but that's what Yusef believes. Good to know. And
so whereabouts was Yusef living? I don't know if you have this pinned down.
This would have been Detroit, I think, as far as I know. Right,
he converted. Cool.
Yeah. But he would have been traveling.
And my earlier claim.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. Yeah, exactly. Right. So we're going to believe that. That confirms our biases.
I'm wondering why you pushed back on that earlier.
Yeah, whatever. It's fine. You were setting me up and I didn't want to give it away.
There we go. Well, it's a callback now.
Yeah, man. And he also, again, was just playing with all these people that were already in this movement. So it probably wasn't, it seems like I've heard different dates. Like they've been like, oh, 1948, he converted, 1950, he converted, 1949. So clearly it wasn't just like
morning, it's like, oh,
I'm a Muslim now. It was like,
a press release.
It was a beautiful blossoming of conscience. Journey. Yeah, exactly.
As it fucking should be.
Also, of course, this was when jazz music, quote unquote, started to get a lot of attention. Just like rock and roll, at first it was the music of sin and iniquity. And slowly people that had white faces warmed up to it. John Coltrane was a big part of that, obviously, too. But Yousef was there. And this is kind of what's interesting is after he toured with Dizzy Gillespie's band, Yousef was like, I'm coming back to Detroit. I'm going to stay there, be with my wife and raise a family. I'm still going to play music. But he was back in Detroit living in the city. I've heard that he worked some day jobs. He worked for Chrysler at one point. But then he started getting music work and he was playing with a quintet or something like that. And then he started studying at school and he was pretty much in and out of universities, both as a student and a teacher for the rest of his life. Hmm. Which I think is a really important thing. And like, yeah, it also, like we talked about, like, he's like jazz was just this thing that was like a very intense study. There was the actual physical side of it and the actual like playing the music. And then there was all this theory and study that was a big part of the culture of it. Right. So Yousef does not record his first album till 1957 when he's 37 years old. So he's a total Instagram inspirational post, you know, I'm 35. So I got a couple of years before I'm not as good as Yousef Lateef.
I might be just a little ripe.
You're good. Whatever. What are you like 22?
Well, that's cool. It seems like a bit of a renaissance man.
I think he was a guy who just did things in his own time.
Yeah.
Not a rushed guy. I really appreciate that. Cause I am a rushed guy. I am a guy that like freaks out about timelines and stuff like that. And I think like a person like this would just be like, it's always like a balm to my soul of like, yeah, they don't care, man. Cause they'll just get it. And like I can get that way, but it takes me like a lot of energy and effort. And it's something I'm trying to cultivate now.
Right.
But I think Yousef just gives off those really like chill to everything a season vibe.
Yeah. Cool as fuck.
Yeah, but even his first album, Jazz Mood, showed those signs of like interest in Eastern music. Like all the instruments on the cover are sort of these traditional African instruments and Eastern instruments. And there's just already that interesting instrumentation, even though the albums are more or less straight ahead, like bop and bebop jazz kind of stuff with a bit of soul mixed in. I should point out that 1957 was also the sort of the birth of modern Pan-Africanism. Kwame Nkrumah was elected president of Ghana that year. So like clearly at some point Yousef crossed over with this. It just seems like we keep talking about this period as being this like fucking intense period of like struggle and strife and beauty and joy and all these things. And it was like, he was just in that. And John Coltrane in an interview says, they ask him like, oh, I saw you went to see Malcolm X. And this is an interview from like around this time. And they were like, how do you feel that you're like connected to that in this weird, like sort of like whatever way. But he answers it like, well, I think that music is the expression of the whole of human experience at any one given time. And I think like these guys were buddies, like they clearly sort of had that in common. And you can't not see sort of like a desire to reconnect connect with all these things in Yousef and John's music. Right. Like they were in the shit. They were in the shit happening and like the stuff that sort of gets whatever romanticized or talked about, but it is like, it was a very important period where a lot of stuff happened, not just in the United States for, you know, descendants of Africans and people of African descent, but like all over the world. Right. It was like that opening of that conversation on colonialism and Pan-Africanism is just such a thing that nobody that I didn't even really start understanding until a year or two ago. And I'm not like, I don't know. I'm a complete noob on that shit, of course, but
yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, it's, a very important political movement.
Yeah. Sure. And I was mean, tied in with jazz essential, as well. So
even, I mean, yeah. given the roots of humanity on the planet.
Yeah, totally.
It is utterly essential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
People who live in one of the most like colonized and I would say oppressed, brutalized continents on the planet, that there is a movement to like fucking look out for themselves, for each other,
and still recognizing that they're not just like a big monolith, right? That there's like it's not like Africanism, it's pan-Africanism. Africa is not a country, you fucks. if I don't know if you were listening to this and you still thought Africa was a country, I don't. You probably are really mad. You've probably just been angry listening to us this whole time because we've probably like pushed every single button you have. I hope so anyway.
I think you just did that thing where you made up.
I made up a guy in my head to get mad at. No.
It doesn't exist.
I'm trying not to do that, but
it may exist. That person may exist, but I doubt they would have
listened. Yeah, I don't. That's like, I don't think anyone actually thinks Africa's a country. I hope not. Can you imagine a guy that thinks Africa's a country?
But now we're getting into like literacy and education levels.
Yeah, I should stop. Sometimes aren't
necessarily people's fault.
Yeah, that's well, that's true. Anyway, Pan-Africanism. Google it.
I think that it's the beginning of. And I mean, I may be wrong, but it seems like it would be around the beginning of the time where the tradition in Black American entertainment of connecting with the African roots, whatever.
Putting on the dashiki and the kufiya.
I know those words. That's kind of where it started from.
Yeah.
This is in kind of its earlier forms, I guess, because there's that much more plurality that I think the information that's available about places, like as an American, you wouldn't necessarily have any stake in anything that's going on in Africa or any particular African country.
Right. Yeah.
But if you wanted to at that time, you could begin to like look into it, or like it's accessible for you to go there.
Exactly.
Whatever.
And
it wouldn't necessarily have been the case.
And speaking of that, Youssef would do that. But not quite yet.
Sure.
He, I think like the other thing is I do want to say like 1957, there was 1957 with Birth of Pan-Africanism, Youssef's first album. He released like 6 albums in 1957, by the way. Some of them were like collaborations, and some of them, clearly he'd been building up material, but he was doing that while he was studying at college and doing all this stuff. And 1959 comes along, and there's a documentary from the BBC called The Year That Changed Jazz, and it focuses on 4 albums, none of them Youssef's, unfortunately, or John's, but John did play on one of them. So I won't get into this too much, but it's important to note that's kind of the year that jazz became respectable, in a sense. Right. And also completely shattered its boundaries. Like it's one of the few counterculture things that's become mainstream that actually got to like do the most outrageous stuff and have that go mainstream. So the 4 albums were Kinda Blue by Miles Davis, Take 5 by the Dave Brubeck Quartet, The Shape of Jazz to Come by Ornette Coleman, and Mingus by Charles Mingus. And I think like some of that is like just like, well, we got this year with these albums, with these figures, right, of like John, of Miles Davis, Charles Mingus, Ornette Coleman, and Dave Brubeck, the token white boy. And if you should watch that documentary because it's really fucking cool. And it's not, I don't want to say there aren't critiques of it or whatever, I don't know. Sure. But that will give you so much background on this that it would take us 3 hours to do. So check that out. Essentially, jazz blew up in a way that it hadn't before. And this was, again, Youssef was like finally releasing albums. He was in this mix, and he was involved. These were his buddies. These were people he like came up with, you know? Yeah. So, and he's sort of seeing it too. Like there's so many albums were released. And he released a bunch of those albums. So in 1960, he goes to New York, and he starts working with Charles Mingus, no less, and as well as some other guys, Babatunde Olatunji, Cannonball Adderley, who was another guy that played with Miles Davis and John Coltrane. And he just like basically like put out albums, like put out a shitload of albums over the years while he was like, he managed to buy a house in New Jersey and put his family there. And then he started touring with Cannonball Adderley. And already he's not only playing saxophone, he's playing flute, he's playing oboe. He's just a full-on like wind machine.
Nice. That's what my fiance calls me.
I wasn't going to say anything, but yeah, you know.
Yeah, I've really been saved by all this whole remote working deal.
Yeah.
Let me off the hook.
You've got this podcast. Why don't you just let it all out through this?
I know where the mute button is.
So
no, that's awesome. So it's lining up for him.
He's just like really like firing on all cylinders, it seems.
So he recorded over 60 albums in his career?
I might be pushing it. He has a page dedicated to his discography on
so like under his name and then that he collaborated.
If you just go to like, if you search Yusef Lateef on Wikipedia, yeah, he has his own page, and then his discography has its own page.
Of course.
So
as any prolific artist would.
Yeah. And a lot of albums, this is pretty normal for jazz guys too. Like, I think people are so used to sort of like the more modern terms where it's like, you know, artists put out a couple albums a year or whatever, but that was not the norm in these days. It was normal to put out a bunch of albums every year. And these guys were, again, like playing, collaborating, doing all this stuff. It was a different time. We'll say it was a different time, but he's already.
You can just sit down for a jam with like a couple of the best musicians ever to date.
Yeah, exactly.
And record it, and there's really no reason why you wouldn't release that.
And people were just hungry for it too, right? For I think sure. There was a market for it and like a system built to funnel it through, right? Yeah. And not necessarily, and I mean, these guys seem to make their living at it, but I don't know if they saw real profits from it or if someone else did or what, right? So, and now that he's back in New York, Yusef connects with John. So it was around 1957. This was finally John's getting clean. I shouldn't use that term. He stopped using drugs a bunch. And he credits his spirituality with quitting these things. And if you know anything about John Coltrane's discography, his later work is all about music, spiritual music. Like, not even like, it's not like gospel for sure. Like, I would not call it gospel in any sense, but just that sort of like, his best record is called A Love Supreme. And it is like a tribute to God, like the most supreme love in his mind. Right. And there are rumors that he wanted to title it Allah Supreme. And I don't know if that's whatever, but like, that's the kind of music he made. And he's reconnecting with Yusef. They're hanging out. They're both in New York. You know, Yusef doesn't have to like come, you know, like pick him up when he has too much or whatever. Yeah, they're just like,
really seems like it played a big role in their dynamic, whether or not he was on drugs.
Yeah. Not. And they're both high on God, in a way, you know, like they're both just really into that shit. They're like, they want to have conversations about capital H him, you know? So they start hanging out and playing and just like practicing together and stuff. And then in 1961, John gives Yusef this drawing. And this is like a big thing. It's called John Coltrane's Tone Circle. There's a bunch of different names for it. We'll have a picture of it in the show notes, and you should go check this thing out because it's nuts. I don't know if you saw it or yet, not yet, Craig.
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's in the outline if you want to check it out. It's just John Coltrane's Tone Circle link. So yeah, John gives Yusef this drawing that's clearly something he's drawn over and over again. To this day, they're still, you know, academics are still like, what is this thing? And you know, people have talked about it. There's five or six really good articles about it. Those will also be in the show notes. It's like just this crazy drawing. It's sort of like a circle of fifths, if you know what that is. But it's got like a Star of David drawn in the middle of it. There's all these circles crossing to notes, in overlapping circles. There's a bunch of numbers going down part of the diagram. And people have like made careers out of studying this drawing and John Coltrane's stuff. But, what people do know is that like every note in it is a tonic for a chord that appears on John Coltrane's famous album, Giant Steps. And right. And John was like very, again, like this was already when they were developing these ideas of like music is a deep spiritual thing that is connected to God and is almost like a, well, John Coltrane believed it was sort of a spiritual language that transcended earthly things or ethnic and cultural distinctions.
Holy shit.
Yeah, John was posthumously canonized as a saint by the African Orthodox Church, which is really fascinating.
He's a,
like, how many jazz musicians are saints, right?
To sainthood.
And Youssef actually published this in a method book he wrote later. That's how we have it. And yeah, people sort of are like, this not only connected to it, there's also a huge mathematical component to it, which I'm not even going to get into because, like, I'm not going to make our podcast about math. I'm just not that guy. But there's a lot of there's math and there's a ton of mathematics to it. There's a ton of music theory to it, and it's just it's and also there's a spiritual dimension and sort of like possibly John believed that these were like the spiritual way, the way to commune with God or something like that, right?
Oh, yeah. Divine diagram.
Yeah, big time. It's very like there's something very mystical and numerological about it, in a very cool way, you know.
I hope humanity survives for long enough to fucking crack some of these really
cool
mysteries. Oh my god.
Yeah. Stop marketing Beanie Babies to teenagers and figure out John Coltrane's Stone Circle, damn it.
Right. That should be like a course at every university.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, no, you're not going to learn how to do advanced calculus. You're going to learn John Coltrane's Stone Circle.
Glorious.
And yeah, after this, this was around the time that John was putting out these really fascinating albums. And interestingly enough, John's first wife, Naima, was a Muslim as well. She deeply influenced his spiritual beliefs. He eventually married another woman, Alice, who also was very fascinated with spirituality, and they worked a lot together. But speaking of spiritual,
I will buy you beer for a month if you can correctly pronounce the surname that Alice Coltrane goes by.
Oh, I didn't even know. I gotta Google this now.
Well, if you don't know it, then you're not gonna be able to pronounce it properly.
Oh no.
It's
polysyllabic
and South Asian.
Turiya Sangitananda. Turiya Sangitananda.
I tried.
You owe me the beer. No.
A month's worth.
Yeah.
And Alice Coltrane is Flying Lotus's aunt.
Really? I didn't know that. That's fucking cool. That's the thing. I think like that's like one of the things that people really want to pretend doesn't exist is the connections between jazz and funk and soul and hip hop and sort of like the way jazz gets like canonized because it's special, whereas like hip hop gets like just thrown in the garbage by, you know, like academia or whatever. And not anymore per se, but was for a long time.
More embraced, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But you could hardly say that Flying Lotus necessarily, I mean, there is obviously a bit of hip hop, but
right. Sorry.
Definitely more of just an electronic experimental musician.
It's electro clash.
But there is, I mean, there's definitely kind of like a, I don't know,
but sort of that
urban aesthetic to it.
And just even post like electronic, any music that was made like hip hop was made with tapes in basements and stuff, right? Like it was very much like a, what am I trying to say? Like it's all like, it's just a completely fundamentally different way of building the music. I don't know. Like, I don't know. I'm just digging myself into a stupid hole.
No, I get what you're saying. Like it is intentionally, like a caricature, not a character. It's like a.
Didn't he also rap though? Like, doesn't he have like a rap persona, a separate rap persona?
But that came up later on his career. His first two albums are just like instrumental, at least his first two albums. I would say even he doesn't even get into like having vocals or having like artists that come on and like do any vocalization on it.
Yeah, right.
Until maybe like Cosmogramma, or I think probably his third. But like the first two albums, if I'm not mistaken, I'm not like a biographer of his or anything, but it's just all instrumentals. And yeah, they're just kind of like him doing electronic jazz, like producing electronic jazz tracks.
Well, and there is that, like, I think of him and like not the same, not even in the same kind of wheelhouse, but like Robert Glasper is another great example. And he's like a full on like electronic jazz musician too. Like, again, yeah, like you would call it jazz.
And Flying Lotus, you would not call it jazz. Because yeah. It's far too much structure, far too much. It is like meant to be in the world of like hip hop and instrumental, experimental.
Well, and I think like, to be fair, like I think also like Flying Lotus has just made it such a different time, I guess, in a way. And like, that's the distinction too, is like that stuff all kind of came in a world where genre was like, had this clear definition, where it's like jazz goes back to sort of that period before the record industry really turned into like a behemoth and was like just sort of like a bunch of competing interests or whatever.
It's all about live music.
Yeah. And yeah. And the jazz was like deliberately designed to be this huge umbrella term, whereas now we use genre to like really specify, you know, sure. Like, and that's the thing, is like, I think the reason jazz
sell it to us better.
Yeah, exactly. And so we can be fed the correct dosage of entertainment units.
Yeah, that conformed to my lifestyle concept.
Exactly. And jazz was just such a different time that like what they just wanted was like a word they could use to describe both like Yusef Lateef and like Billie Holiday, right? You know, and that's the thing. It's like, and that's why a lot of them don't like the term jazz, because jazz is like, there's not an exact correlation between like Yusef Lateef and Billie Holiday, but there's no terminating separation between them. It's just like a continuum.
Yeah.
And that's true of these musics too. It's just, we've found ways to like specifically classify certain styles within it or whatever. Right. Because because it's easier to sell to certain people who want that specific experience. Like, whereas like,
Well, then to identify one another online or even not online,
to be cool, online, to be in the right click.
Yeah, sure. But which genre shirt is that?
Yeah. So, completely defying all known genre conventions, Yusef in 1966 made his first pilgrimage to Mecca. He made two in his life. This was the first one. Nobody wrote anything about this. He didn't, or at least I didn't. I will confess, I didn't finish his autobiography, so maybe he got to that later. I've read about a fifth of it, but it's pretty good so far. He made his first pilgrimage to Mecca in the 60s. And shortly after, he returned to America to assign to Atlantic Records. So, you know, maybe Islam really is the one true religion. I don't know. It just seems like a lucky coincidence.
Yeah.
No. And then literally the year after, John Coltrane died of liver cancer in 1967. Yeah, ups and downs for Yusef. He tells this story in that same YouTube documentary. Apparently, like, John Coltrane came to visit him just before he died, and it's just like this story about two old dudes bonding over hot chocolate. And he kind of has sort of said he has this premonition of John's death, which is very fascinating and interesting. But I recommend that people, if you do one thing beyond listening to this podcast, it's just watch that documentary, because it's like, someone made it just by going to his house and filming him with a camera, but it's a perfect example of what you can do with like no money and a camera and make it really interesting.
Yeah. It's all about having a badass subject.
Yeah, exactly.
That can both be a talking head as well as the music.
A beautiful music entertainer. Yeah. He just films him practicing in his house, and it's just fascinating. That's dope. So yeah. And so he's, you know, John's dead. Clearly, I think Yusef was pretty private about his grief because nothing's really recorded about it. Yusef's got to keep going. What else is he going to do? And in 1969, he gets a bachelor's degree in flute performance, because that's what you do. You get a bachelor's degree. And he continues to take courses while also teaching music theory at the Borough of Manhattan Community College.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah, this just like, this is like the thing. This guy just didn't like, I think the only thing he liked to do was like learn. Like that was really, that was his true like best thing was like, well, what the fuck is this? Well, I'm going to figure it out, basically.
Yeah, expand his musical horizons.
Mm-hmm. And one of those guys that had that intense focus to really like just like fill his life with it, right? Mm-hmm. And
yeah, that's good. I admire people that have that. I mean, I feel like some people that I've encountered in my life have definitely had that like instilled upon them. Maybe better wishes sometimes, which I see as actually probably kind of terrifying, but for sure. I feel like, a little bit more like life filling focus with like a single thing to become just really, really, really good at.
Yeah, totally.
Would be delightful.
Yeah.
It'd be delightful to explore. And there are certain things that I guess maybe I have done to an extent, but you know, you can't really say you're really, really good at, I don't know.
Well, I think like, I guess the one thing is like, we're sort of talking about this guy and being like amazed at his skill and obviously and everything, but like, his is one of the only stories where I didn't see a lot about how his personal relationship suffered. Like I know tons about John Coltrane and Miles Davis and just how much their personal lives and their relationships often suffered because they were so dedicated to this thing. And that's not to say that that didn't happen for Youssef. It's just not part of the story that's out there about him.
So it seems like he struck out a balance, and maybe that whole learning thing, the outlets of, you know, like you said that he worked for Chrysler, it seemed like he had like there were obligations that maybe like anchored him a bit and kept it something that he, I don't want to say didn't take for granted, because that would imply that Miles Davis and John Coltrane did take it for granted,
right? Yeah,
but
he was able to keep it in his mind in a way,
balance it out while still like fully immersing himself.
Yeah. And I think too, he was sort of like, he got fired in 1975, one day before he was eligible for tenure. So fuck you, BMCC. Fuck you, Borough of Manhattan Community College. You fucking assholes. Brutal. Yeah. Brutal and all too common. Especially at the time, apparently, for African-American jazz professors, big thing apparently. And so what did he do? He went back on the road with his family and his band. So this was sort of the beginning of this period of travel for him, where he went to all sorts of countries. Like some of the countries listed are like England, Denmark, Norway, Pakistan, India, Ghana, Egypt, Tunisia. And he did that for 5 years. So clearly he wasn't just like doing a whirlwind tour of these countries. Like he was going there with his family and his band, like a big whole group of people, spending time with them, experiencing these places, doing his second pilgrimage.
Amazing.
Wow,
that's a great format for a tour.
Absolutely. Like as far as I can tell, because he didn't come back. He spent the next 5 years doing that. Basically.
Yeah. Well, think about like the previous statement that, or observation maybe, about how he was somehow able to strike out a balance. Taking your family on tour, an international tour, and not just like, you know, the hottest destinations in Europe where maybe this style of American music is like blowing up necessarily, but places around the world that are going to have, you know, there's going to be an appreciation for it, but there's also a lot to like get from these places too. Not that you can't get a lot from going to Europe or whatever.
Well, and this is the most interesting thing about all that.
It's not the standard destination for like.
Exactly. Exactly. And this is the fascinating thing is when he started doing that, he wouldn't play in any place where alcohol was served.
There you go.
So he's already, and clearly he's like got an audience. Like if you listen to his music, he's not a guy that like someone goes to his concert to get fucked up and party, right? I'm not saying people didn't take substances to enjoy his music. I'm sure they did. But it seems like the audience that would go for his music was someone who wanted to experience the music in a very like active way, in a way that wasn't like, it wasn't party music. It's not like fun. Like it's fun and it's beautiful. And it's a beautiful, joyful expression. but there is like a real, not only intellectual, but spiritual side to his music. So he could clearly do that. But he said in 1999, well, too much blood, sweat, and tears have been spilled creating this music to play it where people are smoking, drinking, and talking.
Yeah, so he didn't want to do like a lounge tour. Yeah, that makes total sense.
And he clearly had the whatever, whether it was like someone was bankrolling him or his, you know, he had all that professor, good professor money, because we all know professors make a shitload of money before they get tenured.
Well, or paid him out for shafting him on that tenure.
Exactly. Or, well, also like
as a gift, as an opportunity, right?
Yeah, totally. And the dude had like 20 records out already. Like he, like who knows? Maybe he had enough royalties. And he had enough of a catalog that, like, you know, whatever. The thing is, like you said, like you found out about him through another artist. And like, I found out about him because I listened to a bunch of other jazz on Spotify and it recommended him to me. And then I was like, wow, what is this? I love this. And I started Googling him. And that was like a few years ago. And I finally was like, hey, I should do an episode on Yousef. But he's not like a household name in the way that like even John Coltrane or like Cannonball Adderley or like McCoy Tyner are, right? Like I didn't necessarily, like my dad is a huge jazz fan. And when I texted him, I was like, hey, I'm doing this episode on Yousef Latif. He was like, I don't know who that is, which like, that's also just my dad. But sure. So yeah, I just think he's like such an incredible artist and fascinating. And then he does this tour from 1975 to 1980, tours all over the world, probably coming home with his family, with his band, just a big old fun time. They're playing it clean. They're keeping it straight edge. He does his second pilgrimage to Mecca, and then he goes to Nigeria and he spends 5 years there as a senior research fellow at the Center for Nigeria Cultural Studies at the biggest university in Nigeria. Which is located in one of the original Hausa people's city states, apparently. And they're one of the biggest sort of West African Muslim groups.
Okay.
And he just basically like embraced, I think like West African, Islam and that culture and the Nigerian culture. Because he did two albums in this period. Also, he's on tour. He's playing all these songs. He's doing all this stuff. He's with his family. He writes a method book. Drops that. That's the one that has the John Coltrane diagram in it. And we'll have a link in the notes if you want to check it out. Then he goes to Nigeria, senior research fellow. He's also co-writing a book that was commissioned by the Minister of Culture with a Nigerian dramaturge named Ziki Kofoworola. I will cut in with a correct pronunciation on that later. So he's literally doing all this stuff. And while he's doing all that, he records two albums.
Nice.
Wow. These are sort of his two most, interesting albums. One is Yousef Latif in Nigeria, which is him on various wind instruments accompanied by traditional Hausa, Yoruba, and Tiv drummers. And it's a big, it's like sort of a big gathering of all these drummers, and it's a really unique album. And apparently in the liner notes, he sort of does all this connecting of a little guy named Albert Einstein's theories and another physicist who built off his work named Fritjof Capra. So he connects theories of elastic time with arpeggios and riffs and notes from John Coltrane's Giant Steps. And he sort of says these were like the inspirations for him doing this album.
Wow.
And cool. I just think like that's like, again, we see this like auto physio psychic music, right? Mm-hmm. He eventually wrote a method book on that too. Just like a guy who just like does everything, just like absolutely amazing. And then he recorded another album, which was very similar, called Hikima, which is creativity in the Hausa language. And that didn't actually get a wide release until 2019.
Oh, wow.
So it was like a hidden secret album that they just released like a year ago. And those are probably like, there's other albums that are more overall out there. Like this is more just like these traditional Nigerian drums with, it's just these traditional Nigerian drums that were rarely recorded for the West ever.
It consists of basically these two components.
Yeah.
and drums and him playing wind instruments on top.
Yeah. And then singing and stuff too. But okay. Like the nice thing about this guy is like, you can start with albums like you said, like that song Eastern Market is on an album called Yusef Lateef's Detroit. And it is like basically a straight ahead funk soul album with a bunch of really good jazz lines and some strange instrumentation. So he's got those albums where you're like, oh, I like, you know, if I like John Coltrane or if I like Miles Davis, I can listen to these couple albums and I can just enjoy that they're basically a similar thing to that with just like a slightly different instrumentation. Or you can listen to like this and get a completely different experience that's almost much more like maybe like an Afrobeat album like or something like that, or just like,
yeah.
And then you can also get his album like Meditations, which is literally this super ambient atmospheric meditations that are literally just like Meditation 1, Meditation 2, and they're all unique and different, but but he just did so many different albums that anyone who likes any sort of version of this music can get into him.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah,
I'm just interested in creating expressions
and experimenting, and that's the thing.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, and he had albums that like I'm like, I don't like this album, but like he tried something, right? Like they're all so different.
That's the thing.
And yeah, so he goes back to the US in 1985 and records this album, another great album that I think people should check out, Yusef Lateef's Little Symphony. Plays every single instrument on the album, just like putting us all to shame, like all the like rise and grind people just like bow down to Yusef Lateef doing everything.
Every instrument.
And that album wins Best New Age Performance at the Grammys in 1988.
Wow.
He said he was grateful for the award, but he didn't know what New Age music was. Which is like such an old man, but like also like I can just picture him saying it in the like, not in the like, oh, I don't know what, like not in a cynical way, but just in a like, well, thanks. I don't know what the fuck this is, but thank you.
Swears, yeah, tag me. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, New Age is anything where you play all the instruments.
Exactly. Said. That's it. It's just, oh, okay, cool. Thanks. I did do that. so he then just, again, University of Massachusetts hires him as an associate professor of music. And this one, luckily, he does stay and get tenure.
There we go.
So a little bit of revenge, but not, you know, still whatever. Shouldn't have happened in the first place. He should have got tenure all these years ago, but it's just God had a different plan for him, you know.
Yeah, totally.
He eventually became a distinguished professor, which I believe is the highest academic rank or something like that. And he founded his own album, YAL Records, which is, of course, his initials. And he that was really when he did all his just like absolutely out there stuff, experimenting a lot more. And a lot of the articles about him note that he actually got more productive in his later years. Like once he hit like the 70s and 80s and 90s, he was really just like pushing the albums out and doing novels. He started writing novels, started doing drawings, which you can all see on his website. He wrote essays. He wrote method books. Like he really just is like that guy who just like was like, he was like, if you know how like the idea of like a mad scientist who is like knows every single science discipline, that was Yusef Lateef, but for music.
Yeah. That's cool.
He's yeah.
Mad musician.
Yeah. And that's what he did for the rest of his life. And like, I don't have a lot beyond this on that, but like, just know that there's like a million albums that he made in this period that are awesome and you should check out.
Subject.
Yeah. And then he wrote an autobiography in 2005, which I have and I'm reading. It's pretty good so far. And then sadly in 2008, his masters were destroyed when the Universal Studios lot caught fire and a bunch of Universal Music Group masters were destroyed.
Buddy.
Yeah. So I was like, what?
You had one job, Universal
Music Group. Yeah, exactly. And you can't even do that right. Why weren't there backups? Like, well, I know why.
pillaging and stealing masters off of artists for decades and decades and decades only to have them burnt in your warehouse.
Yeah, exactly. Just sitting in there doing nothing. And then they burn down. Yeah. It's like, that's the thing. I'm like, why weren't there fucking backup masters? I don't under, or like Like, I don't know. Just
what a bunch of schlubs.
Like, exactly, right? Come on. You guys are supposed to be this. You're supposed to be the Universal Studios. You're supposed to be Universal, and you guys lose Masters?
Some sort of, like, fireproof bunker that shit would be.
Exactly. But no, they were probably just sitting on, like, the big old, like, the back lot where they shot, like, fucking Breakfast at Tiffany's, and they were just like, well, we're not going to tear that down because we might use it again someday. Yeah.
Breakfast at Tiffany's too. Brunch.
Well, and it's funny because, like, he not only never, I don't think he ever recorded for Universal. I think he recorded for, like, five other labels that all eventually got fucking bought by Universal. Like,
so that was, they were like, oh, okay, well, let's take the cream and then everything else we'll just shove in this tinderbox.
Yeah, and it's just like, they're just like, we just bought 50 of Yusef Lateef's albums. Put them in the vault. That's it. You know, like, yeah. Fuck.
Yeah,
but they were probably waiting for him to die so they could just release a bunch of editions and make money off it too, right? Like, yeah. Yeah, exactly. But yeah, that was sort of like his music's still available. Like I said, you can check it out everywhere. It's just the masters are gone, so they can never. Sadly, I guess in a way it's good because they can never go back and like remaster all his recordings and not pay his family for them.
Yeah, it's true that it's deprived them of the opportunity to screw over the next generation of the Lateef family.
Yeah, totally. Well, but I hope
that's all of humanity of being able to enjoy a lot of it.
Exactly. So fuck you. Yeah. I mean, that is the good thing about him making his own label and keeping it independent, is it seems like they're still getting money that way. At least I hope, right? Like a lot of his later stuff and his method books are all released through his own.
Yeah, well, that's the way, obviously the smarter way to do things.
Yeah, right? Totally. And not only
big institutions don't have our best interest in mind.
Yeah, I wonder if he got screwed occasionally, you know?
Sure. Yeah, he learned his lesson. Yeah. He was like, yep, I'm going to do it, DIY it.
Well, and once he had, like, and again, like, it's not even that other people didn't want to do that. It's just they didn't have the means. And clearly at some point he had the ability to, on some level, build a record label that would actually get his stuff out to his fans, but there's also people. Then put the money back to him rather than everybody else.
So, for sure.
Yeah. And then he died in 2013. Sadly.
Oh, that wasn't very long ago.
No, he was 93 when he died. Or,
I guess, like, he was still making music.
He was so close. He was so fucking close, you know? I think his last album came out before that. Like, I think his last album came out in like 08 or 09 or something like that. And I don't think it was like new music, but yeah. He's like one of those people that went from like literally the age of the robber barons to like the age of the MP3, you know? Yeah, like, I think that's interesting. Yeah. Like, there's very few people like that. There's like a filmmaker who's like 100 and who he lived to be 111. He made his first film in the silent era and he made his last film when he was in his like hundreds. And it's just like, and he was just like this weird little indie private filmmaker. But like, think about that. Like, you know, there are people that leave industries because they change so much, they can't handle it anymore. Or the public just loses interest in them and they can't make enough money to stay afloat, or they can't, like, they don't have they're not lucky enough to get the things they need to like keep making music or whatever, or they're just like, fuck it, I'm not going to fucking do it anymore. Right. And Yusef is like one of those guys that just like, it didn't matter. He just like put records out. He studied music. He learned music. He incorporated into his physical, emotional, and spiritual self.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, is when you're not really tapped into the ebbs and flows of like cultural trends and like the waves of fads and popular culture and what's marketable and what people will sign big contracts for or whatever, but you're tuned into like the science and physicality and spirituality of music and like creation and artistry, then you're always relevant, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there's no such thing as irrelevant, because music is, yeah, I don't know. It's only when you make it all about that former stuff that becoming irrelevant, quote unquote, becomes a threat.
Yeah, right? Exactly. That's a really good way to put it.
You've prized the relevance, the spotlight, is what it was about. And so, and everybody knows that that doesn't last.
No. Except for me, it'll last for me.
of course
it'll last for me as a podcaster and us, and by extension you, Craig, obviously.
I'm here for that glow. I'm just here for the
whatever
the sort of light bounces off Joe,
off my majesty. now that I've decided to become an all-time podcaster, I'm gonna be the Yusef Lateef of podcasting.
Published a book about podcasting. He published 3 volumes.
A method book.
Continued podcasting into his 120s, which is an average age to die. In the year 2100.
Yeah, somehow I reversed aged into my 20s. That was the problem, was when Raytheon started experimenting with chronoton bombs and turned time backwards, and I died in my 20s. Yeah, and I don't call them podcasts. I call them autophysiopsychicocasts, just to be clear. I don't like the term pod. I think it's too juvenile.
Yes,
indeed. I don't like what it's become these days. Very the kids with their head podcasts that they beam directly into their brains as I de-age in front of them. I need to write this shit down, man. So that's Yusef Lateef. He was a G. He was just... Excellent.
All about the music.
An all-timer, a real, and he just seems watching that documentary, you're just like, oh, he's such like a lovely old man who just, you just want to like, you just want to hear him talk for hours. You could just be like, yeah, that's a cool story. So watch that YouTube video.
No, I definitely will do.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks. Really good subject. I enjoyed it. Some really fun tangents we went off into.
Some amazing tangents, I think.
I feel like Wes would be proud.
Wes would be very proud. He's going to edit this, so he's going to hear all about it. He's going to be like, I should have brought them back on track here. I should have Tom Joe down. I should have kept him from whatever. But no, it was a great episode, and we hope you guys all liked it. We don't know what we're going to do next time, but I think we'll have a special guest, so stay tuned. And thank you again for listening to Second Bananas. You can follow us at Two Bananas Pod on Instagram and Twitter. And please, if you like the podcast, rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play. I don't think you can rate and review on Spotify, but please follow us on Spotify.
Try and do it anyways. Try and find the where you can.
We are on YouTube now. There's a playlist link somewhere in our social media. You can do all the interactivity and engaging in social media with us that you like to further your brand and ours. And we really appreciate it.
Harass, stalk, abuse is welcome.
Yeah, definitely. We love that. That's our favorite thing. Come yell at me on Twitter or whatever. But please give us a review and a rating and check us out. And we'll see you next time on the next episode of Second Bananas.